You're getting very sleepy. Actually, I hope not, but those words spoken in that particular tone make most of us think of being hypnotized. And hypnosis is the subject of today's edition of Please Explain, particularly as it is used in therapies of many kinds. Joining us is Dr. Philip R. Muskin, the Chief of Consultation Liaison in Psychiatry at the Columbia University Medical Center of New York Presbyterian Hospital. He's also a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center and a faculty member of the Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. Awful lot of different things there. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And we also invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. And you can also join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Dr. Muskin, let's start with the most basic thing. What is the medical definition of hypnosis?
Well, the medical definition of hypnosis doesn't involve sleep. The term hypnosis, which came from James Braid in England, from hypnose, which means sleep. But the medical definition of hypnosis is it is a state of consciousness, actually, that involves three qualities: dissociation, absorption, and suggestibility. And when people are hypnotized, they're anything but asleep, but in fact, in a very focused state of concentration. But the media certainly does have gold watches going back and forth, or spirals, and or Dracula hypnotizing people in a way that looks very frightening, but anything but what real hypnosis is.
So nobody uses a watch being moved back and forth?
I don't think anyone uses a watch anymore. No.
But it did work in the past.
All those techniques work. That is, focusing on a single spot works. Watching a spiral works. There's something called the hypnotic induction profile, which involves rolling your eyes up. Ericksonian hypnosis might be, we're going to walk down 10 steps, and on the first step, and so on and so on and so on. But all those techniques are doing is allowing the person to enter into the trance state on his or her own. In fact, you don't really hypnotize someone else. The person is guided to hypnotize himself.
Are both the mind and the body engaged in the process, or is this simply a mental thing?
Well, there is no such thing as simply mental, in that our brains, where our minds reside, are biological organs. They work on chemicals, as we all know. And those chemicals and the salts that are in the brains create what looks like electricity when you measure it from the outside. There's no real electricity in the brain. And think of it this way. Think of the brain as being billions of cells that organize themselves into circuits or tracks, no different than in the ceiling of your apartment or all the wires that control the various lights in your house. And think of the mind as being the person sitting at the controls. And the mind then decides which of those circuits is on or off, which circuits are talking to each other. And so in our regular conscious state, as we're talking right now and the people who are listening, they're probably doing five different things, right? They're listening to the program, they're on their computers, they're on their phones, they're eating lunch, etc. In hypnosis, you focus yourself down to do one thing, and all those circuits that are distracting you, you voluntarily turn off. So it's really a both, mind, brain, and body.
And I'm assuming we see that when we put somebody in a hypnotic state into an MRI.
Yes, we do. And there are neuroanatomical correlates of the trance state. There are electroencephalographic, that is EEG, correlates. So when you go into the trance state, the EEG is predominantly alpha waves, which is the alert brain getting ready to do something. In the MRIs and in the PET scans, where they measure what the brain is actually doing in a biological way, how much oxygen or glucose the brain is using, we see a whole variety of areas light up, one in particular, the anterior cingulate cortex. And that's a part of our brain that basically biologically decides the emotional quality of something. Is it important emotionally? Is it not important emotionally? So it's not just that the brain is turned off. The brain is really turned on, but special parts of the brain are turned on.
And that would apply to everyone as we look at a brain scan?
Well,
or the different parts of the brain for different people?
No, it looks from the data that we have is that the same parts of the brain light up in different people who are in trance states. But people vary in their ability to be hypnotized. And like everything in biology, there's that bell curve with a few people at the low end and a few people at the high end, and most of us living in the middle.
So some people are more susceptible. And you said that it really is the person himself who hypnotizes. So could a listener to a radio show be hypnotized over the air?
Probably. I think we've all seen those state fairs where there's a hypnotist in a tent, and the hypnotist asks for volunteers, and several people raise their hands, and several people don't. And the people who raise their hands, most of them seem to go into a trance, and then they're told to act like chickens, etc. And some of those people are highly hypnotizable. They may or may not be aware that they're highly hypnotizable, and they readily go into the trance state and take the suggestion. And so I guess it's possible that people listening over the radio right now could be hypnotized if they chose to listen to those suggestions.
What would I have to suggest?
Oh, well, it would be to... There are lots of ways to do that. One way would be make yourself comfortable, close your eyes, don't do anything else right now, just listen. And as you are sitting in a comfortable chair, imagine that you're going to take 10 steps from wherever you are into a lush forest. And as you take step one, you're leaving the room that you're in, and just imagine that you can see the trees and the leaves, and you can smell the dirt on the ground, you hear the birds cheeping. And as you take step two, think of yourself now moving into the forest just a little bit. You can feel the leaves crunching under your feet. And as you take step three, perhaps it gets a little cooler, and so on and so on and so forth until we got to step 10. And people who were able to let themselves go into that state, what I think is happening is the engineer in their minds is switching the circuits, sort of like a very fancy train set. And as those circuits switch, they start to pull themselves into an absorbed state. That is, they're not paying attention to what's going on around them. They are dissociating. That is, they're disconnecting the major awareness that we all have into listening to my voice and imagining what the images I'm trying to create. And in that state, they would be suggestible, but not suggestible in the sense of I have a really nice bridge that I can sell you,
mm-hmm.
but suggestible in the sense of taking in new information in a non-critical way.
Now, is there a difference between stage hypnosis and therapeutic hypnosis, or would the hypnotist be pretty much doing the same thing?
I think the hypnotist is pretty much doing the same thing. In stage hypnosis, obviously, the individual who has volunteered for some interior motive of wanting to display him or herself in front of other people. In therapeutic hypnosis, the trance state is not itself therapeutic. It's a state, but it's a palette upon which the patient and the professional with whom the patient is working can now paint a picture that itself would be therapeutic. I'll give you an example. You would like to stop smoking. And by the way, this doesn't work if you don't want to stop smoking. It is if your spouse says, don't come home with any more cigarettes, and you love smoking, you can see any hypnotist you want. You're not going to stop smoking. But if you come to the conclusion, I love my cigarettes, I love smoking, but I know this is bad for me, I want to stop, then a hypnotist might work with you not to tell you, okay, Leonard, you will never touch another cigarette. If you do, you will throw up and you will never smoke again, but might say, you know, smoking is a poison for your body, and your body does all these good things for you. You know, you count on your body every day. And don't you owe your body respect and protection? And in the hypnotic trance, you would repeat that to yourself. I must protect my body, for my body smoking is a poison. I owe my body this respect and protection. And every time you wanted a cigarette, you would put yourself in the trance. You would reflect on what you're doing for yourself, and then you would come out of the trance.
Now, I quit smoking by doing the same thing without hypnotizing myself.
Of course. Well, you used the same principles, correct?
I just simply knew that smoking was making me cough all the time, and it was, and I'd read all this stuff about cancer and emphysema and said, this is bad for me. It took a long time. It was very difficult, but I would say to myself again and again, you don't want to do this to yourself. So I guess I was doing the equivalent of hypnosis without hypnotizing myself.
I want to make one thing clear. Hypnosis is not an abnormal state. It is a completely normal state. We are in trances, every single one of us, every single day. I'll give you examples that everyone has had. You're driving along a highway that is 50 miles to the next rest stop. And you're driving along and driving along and driving along. And you can't really remember how you got from point A to point B. And I'm not talking about being asleep, because when you're asleep, you tend to find yourself off the road. That is, the monotony of the road has induced a trance in you. Or you're sitting at work, and or maybe sitting in a somewhat boring lecture, and you're not sleepy, and you start to think to yourself, how much is the lottery this week? I think it's a lot this week. I'm going to play. It's only a dollar. And if I win, I'll have hundreds of millions of dollars. And then I'll buy a house in Tahiti, and I won't ever work again. Those are all words. But some people start the same way. I'll spend a dollar on the lottery, and I'll win. And the next thing they know, they're in Tahiti. And they can smell the surf, and they're really enjoying themselves. They're not asleep. Both those people have entered trance states, but somewhat different trance states. So daydreams are a form of trancing.
We have a call. We have lots of calls, actually, but we have a call from Robert from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a similar experience when I was in high school. I was a wrestler, and we used to have to cut a lot of weight. It's now illegal, but I had a craving for donuts, and it was really killing my ability to make weight. And it was a small town in western Kansas, and there was a hypnotist he was like 90 years old, and I thought I'd go and try him. And what he did really sounded very similar. He relaxed me. I went through different suggestions, and I never really went under, and I was aware I was being hypnotized, and he talked about donuts. And after that, he completely cured me of going to the donut shop and having 6 donuts before school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was aware of it consciously, and it was kind of weird because there was, I was aware that I'd been hypnotized. There was a consciousness that it happened, and I thought it was kind of funny that it was working. But it still basically, took off the edge. And even today with a wonderful planet, the organic donuts you can get in New York that try to make it healthy, I still look at those donuts, and even though they're organic and you have fresh pistachios and all, the urge to occasionally have a donut, but it was a very sort of enlightening experience about the sort of mix between the conscious and unconscious, and not going under like the cliche, like dance like a chicken.
But you remember the whole process.
Yeah.
Now, doctor, in some of the stage hypnosis, the hypnotist says, you will not remember any of this, and the person doesn't remember. But then they can be, like the Manchurian candidate, they can be made to do something again, despite the fact that they don't remember.
Well, the Manchurian candidate, which is, of course, both versions of the movie are very scary. That's brainwashing. And the reality is, in brainwashing, you can pretty much get people to do whatever you want. I would say that in the stage version of hypnosis, the two things are happening. There are some people who are just faking. They like to get up on the stage and they like to act silly. And when they say they don't remember, they're just playing along and they're having a good time. But there are people who are extremely hypnotizable. And of the grades of hypnotizability, the grade 5 hypnotizability is rare. I actually think it's a combination of a gift and a burden. But those people are so hypnotizable that if they're in an audience and they volunteer, they will go into the trance and they will not remember. And they can be made to do things again and again. And some of those people are extremely creative. They can really dip into themselves in a very focused way. But for some, it gets them into trouble. They may have seemingly medical symptoms that no one can explain. But in fact, what's happening is they're in the trance state. I think the example that you gave is very interesting because many athletes are much more hypnotizable than they realize. And being a wrestler, it's tough to be a wrestler. It's tough to cut weight. You know, the don't look back, ball and chain. I know something about wrestling. Yeah. Dealing with that, that's hard work.
Well, and Robert, did you give up the donuts because you wanted to or because you just needed the encouragement?
I mean, I wanted to because I realized that they were, you know, they weren't good for me and they weren't helping me make weight. And I think also with sports, there's the ritualistic aspect, you know, so hypnotism had some of those elements. And as I look back on it now, I guess one question I'd have is, how would you define the difference between hypnosis and, let's say, a guided meditation? Because when I look back, it almost feels like he took me on a little trip. And in that trip, I was in a relaxed state. But it almost, like you say, it opened it up, but it was shockingly effective for me.
And many people have been calling in to find out whether there is a similarity between this and various forms of meditation, including transcendental meditation. Mm-hmm. And we will take a little break, and when we come back, we'll get the answer from you and speak to other listeners and delve a little further into the whole matter of hypnosis, because it's the subject of today's Please Explain. My guest is Dr. Philip R. Muskin, Chief of Consultation Liaison in Psychiatry at the Columbia University Medical Center of the New York Presbyterian Hospital. He's a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center and a faculty member of the Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. Stay with us for more. We are back with today's Please Explain Look at Hypnosis with Dr. Philip R. Muskin of Columbia University. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's take another call. This one is from Stephen. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Okay, so... First, I volunteered to be hypnotized at this meeting where they brought in a hypnotist as a featured speaker. I went in front of the room, in front of everyone, and I followed his instructions. And what he did was he applied a huge amount of pressure. He was pinching me, and I could not feel the pain while I was, you know, hypnotized, and I didn't notice it until afterwards because it really did hurt afterwards. He's a very big guy. The other thing was that my grandmother complained that she was having trouble sleeping, and I told her, I asked her what her favorite color was, and she said it was green. I said, when you close your eyes, imagine the color green. She said, how do I do that? I said, just do it. Try, do your best and see what happens. And I asked the hypnotist if that visualization technique, you know, if I hypnotized my grandmother, and he said I did.
I would agree. You got her to absorb herself into the color green, to dissociate from the world around her, and you gave her a suggestion. When you focus on the color green, you'll find it easier to fall asleep.
So could hypnosis be good for insomniacs?
Absolutely.
Do I have to learn hypnosis because I live with an insomniac?
You live with an insomniac? So you would want to train your partner to do it? Absolutely, because hypnosis would not put you to sleep, but hypnosis and in a trance, you could pull away from the day and allow the normal fatigue you have to take over. And if you woke up in the middle of the night, as happens to many people, you could put yourself back in the trance. Sometimes people say, well, if I go into a trance and I fall asleep, that's it. I'll be in a trance for the rest of my life. But since hypnosis is a focused state of concentration, the minute you fall asleep, the trance ends. So you can't get trapped in a trance.
Now, what about the pain that was imposed on Robert? Why didn't he feel pain?
Because he was in a trance. So let's translate Robert's experience to something that is very well described, combat. I mean, people get injured in combat all the time. But very often in the middle of a firefight, we know this from the World War II experience, from the Normandy Beach experience, men were injured. They were in mortal danger. And when the medics got to them, they didn't need morphine.
Well, endorphins took over, didn't they? The body provides its own opiates.
The body does provide its own opiates, but in states like that, people naturally go into a trance to protect themselves. They dissociate, they absorb, and they say to themselves, right now, I have to be as focused as I can until I get evacuated because there are bombs floating and bullets flying. So when Robert went into a trance, he was able to, in his brain, switch the circuit that normally would say, that hurts a lot, to off so that it didn't hurt. And when he came out of the trance, the pressure on wherever it was applied was now sending a pain signal. So his thalamus, which makes the decision about what you are aware of and or what you're not aware of, his thalamus was basically being switched off in the trance state. That's what makes trancing so remarkable, is we can do things that we think are impossible.
Now, what about transcendental meditation or some of the other things that we see in religious rituals? Are they a form of hypnosis?
Yes. They are what Herbert Spiegel, who is one of the prominent American psychiatrist, hypnotist who passed away a few years, would call a neural trance, meaning that the brain is active at these times. You're not being instructed to go into a trance state. But during a religious ceremony or when you meditate, you know, think about meditation being a transcendental meditation, open focus, any of the other styles of breath technique meditation. You're pulling your awareness in. You're disconnecting, you're absorbing yourself into the mantra, or you're absorbing yourself into saying Om. You're doing this one thing with all of your mental ability. And what I think is happening is you are naturally entering your trance state. And that's not good or bad. That's a foundation. Then within the trance state, if you recite your mantra, or if you focus just on making yourself comfortable and focusing on nothing else, a whole number of physiological things happen, one of which is the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system, which are constantly, our autonomic nervous system, keeping our heart rate up, making our heart rate slower, keeping our blood pressure up, lowering our blood pressure. That in states like meditation and like trancing, the parasympathetic nervous system starts to predominate, so your heart rate initially goes up, and then it slows down. Your blood pressure initially goes up, and then it slows down. And it turns out, you feel really good when you do things like that.
Now, Freud believed in using hypnosis.
He was well-trained.
Excuse me?
He was well-trained in hypnosis.
And how successful was he in getting people to stop being neurotic?
Well, you know, Freud gave up hypnosis, and Freud's technique of hypnosis was to apply pressure on the forehead, as I understand it. And his early colleague, Joseph Breuer, used hypnosis to uncover traumatic memories. And Freud gave up hypnosis, as I understand it, because one of his patients said, if you stop pressing on my forehead, I will stop doing this. And also because during a trance state, one of his patients jumped up from the couch and threw her arms around him. And I think Freud was a great observer. He looked at things in a very careful way. I think Freud recognized that lying on the analytic couch with your analyst behind you, not seeing the person, not even necessarily hearing the person, allowed people to naturally enter a state, perhaps a trance state, where they could recover memories that they had suppressed, where they could think about themselves in a different way. And for anyone who's ever been in psychoanalysis, when I've asked people about this, being an analyst and talking to analysts, when you're in that state, 45 minutes can go by and your analyst says, well, time's up. And you say, what do you mean? I just got here. Or you recover a dream, and in the dream you remember something from your childhood, and it's very real, and you cry, and you really understand its meaning. I think that those are trance states, and Freud just decided at some point, I don't need to induce this. I'll just let the patients go into it on their own.
But the whole business of remembering repressed memories got distorted, as we saw, certain point. So in some cases, could it be because people are also suggestible when they're in a hypnotic trance?
And this is one of the reasons to pick a hypnotist who isn't just a hypnotist. That is, pick a hypnotist who's a psychiatrist, pick a hypnotist who's a psychologist, pick a hypnotist who's a licensed social worker. That is, the work of hypnosis should be done by someone trained, because in a suggestible state, as you just said, it could well be that the hypnotist has an idea of what happened to you, and subtly, and even well-meaningly, starts to suggest it to you, and the next thing you know, you recover a memory that never existed.
Let's take another call. Michelle, hi, you're on the air. Michelle from Westchester. Are you there, Michelle?
If you're looking for me, this is Julietta, not Michelle. I think she may have gotten my name wrong.
Okay. Are you a hypnotist?
I am a hypnotist.
Okay, hi.
Hi. And I specialize in working with pregnant women. I'm a trained childbirth educator, labor doula, and everything the doctor's saying is absolutely true. And I do a lot of work actually via Skype and telephone, and it is very effective. I think that was one of your questions. And
so you can hypnotize over the phone?
Absolutely.
What would you say? Because I want to see if we can do this to my audience.
Well, I start very similarly to what the doctor says, but I ask people to imagine the place that they want to be. So for some people, it's not a forest. It's the ocean. Very often, it's an ocean scene with water. And then going through the steps of the progressive relaxation and then what we call induction, which is counting down from 10 to 1 or 15 to 1. And then in that space, when the person is very relaxed and in that highly focused state of concentration, depending on what they want to focus on, whether they're focusing on the birth and wanting to have a more positive birth, let's say they've had a cesarean last time and they're aiming to have a natural vaginal birth this time, they'll imagine.
You don't need an epidural in this case.
Pardon me?
This is better than an epidural.
Heck yeah. And a lot safer.
I have to. I'm pretty much out of time, unfortunately, so I have to leave it there. We do have the word mesmerize, named after Franz Mesmer. And he was a show.
Magnetism.
Say that again.
Mesmer believed in what he called animal magnetism, but I suspect he just was a gifted hypnotist.
And so we wind up being mesmerized. Can't take any more calls. I'm really sorry, because there are a lot of people who have fascinating questions. One of them, can you be, after hypnosis, can you be induced to do a bad thing?
I would say 99.99% of the time, no. If you knew the hypnotist very well and trusted the hypnotist very much and were yourself at grade 4 or grade 5 hypnotizability, then maybe. But I'm setting up a very special condition.
Dr. Philip R. Muskin is Chief of Consultation Liaison in Psychiatry at the Columbia University Medical Center at New York Presbyterian Hospital. I thank you so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Thank you.